Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 16th, 2005. Today's session is entitled The Disabled God, presented by Nancy Iceland. Disc number EIN 2005-04.
It's sort of I was trying to figure out, you know, after you've written something and you kind of trying to figure out, how do you tell people about it in ways that maybe interest them? And so I'm going to tell you a little about how it came to be, and then about what I think it is, and then we'll have a passage where I'll tell you a little about this experience of my first experience with the disabled God. And it was an experience as well as a kind of theological thinking out. So Antonio, I'm supposed to say, Antonio will burn this, I think he starts it. We've been talking all week about, in various sessions, about questions of inclusion and reconciliation and sort of thinking about how to live in somebody else's space, just for a while, what I call empathic hope, the process of really working at the interplay with our experience and someone else's. And it's never easy. And so when I talk today about the disabled God, for some of you, it's kind of probably a jarring sort of notion. And so I appreciate your willingness to come on a perfectly good day when you could, the ice cream shop was open, so you all could be elsewhere. And so I'm very appreciative of you coming here. And so I also want to say, you know, there's places where it just seems like I don't understand that, I don't get it. Please just stop me, and we'll have a conversation about it as well, because I want us to do that back and forth if we can. I've said before, but because these sessions are not really, they don't really build, they're all freestanding, and some of you I'm seeing for the first time, but I am a person with a congenital disability, a lifelong disability, that has been relatively unstable over time and resulted in a lot of hospitalization in my early years. I had mentioned last session that I ended up being March of Dimes poster child because I was in the rehab hospital, you know, and braces and all of these things. And so my experience with disability is really one of physical disability. But my eldest sister and a family of six children is a person with significant developmental disability as well, and lives with my parents still. And so I want to talk, I can't really talk from her experience. She and I have talked a lot about the ways in which things differ for her and for me. And it was a different experience having both forms of disability in a family. Because historically, the disability movement divided out disability-specific sort of advocacy. And most developmental disability advocacy was done by parents of children with developmental disabilities. And so it's relatively recently that the advocacy of folks with developmental disability has been done by themselves. They're self-advocates increasingly. And that's a challenge. And Kathy has, over the years, learned how to do self-advocacy, even as I have. So I'll talk a little about her experience, but the experience of the kind of revelation of the disabled God is really experienced out of my own physical disability experience. So some people, you'll think of other disabilities that that model of God may not work exactly in the same way, but I hope you'll use the heuristic device. I'm going to stand because I move around just a bit because I find myself needing to do that. So, one of the things I learned as I worked through the experience of my disability over a lifetime was that the theological responses for disability were really pretty poor. There really weren't a lot of available good theological responses. There were things like, you're a sacrament of God. You hear that sometimes. Often that is used in particular, I have to say, for folks with developmental disabilities where there's a kind of infantilizing experience, right? That they, you know, sort of, they become the sacrament of God. And I have to say, for a while, that was a welcome. I was something to God, right? That, you know, I sort of utilized the halfway measures we can do. I was something to God. And so I thought about that. You know, what does it mean to be a sacrament to God, a sacrament in the community? And often it was a sacrament of suffering, right? It was a way of sort of, as I just said, giving people particular roles, saying in some ways, as I use the metaphor, you're the designated driver of suffering. You know, you get that. You do that for the community. So after a while, I found that not only didn't particularly link me to God, but it made me feel exceptional in the community. I talk about in the Disabled About God, the experience I've had a number of times in very many lovely congregations, and it's not an intentional affront, but the experience of when I use a wheelchair often, and maybe in church sometimes with a wheelchair, and an usher will come to me and say, "You can remain here, and we'll come serve you." And it's a very kind. They're trying to think about how to include, but it also changes the sacrament of the Eucharist and makes your body in some ways a different sacrament, not the communal sacrament. And so I have thought through, I've worked on this question of sacrament, can it be utilized? And I was in theology school at the time, and I had a wonderful teacher, Rebecca Chopp, who I spoke about earlier in the week, feminist theologian, now university president at Colgate. I was talking to her about how I was trying to work with these theologies that just were like bad fitting shoes. You know, you kept working on them and they just never wore in. And she said to me, "You know, Nancy, sometimes you'll have to do a theology all new. That's just the way it works." And she was talking about out of her own experience of having worked with Latin America liberation theology in her early years. And I, you know, that seemed a tremendously audacious sort of comment. And my experience through seminary was one of kind of constantly trying to figure out a way that these theologies might work. And I was then invited to, I was in a wheelchair at that time, and I was invited to do a Bible study at the Shepherd Spinal Center, it was called then. It's a nationally known location for folks who had initially the hospital was that it was traumatic spinal cord injury. And so there were lots and lots at that time young men who had been in violent accidents or violent encounters with guns, and so were experiencing disability out of an experience in which their lives were absolutely transformed by it. It was not like my congenital disability, where I sort of lived through it and lived with it. And I used to think I'd wheel into these, into the Bible study, and I think I embodied their worst fear. I was, all of them wanted this to be over. They wanted a full healing of their bodies, and so the theology of healing was the one they wanted to talk about the most. And so as I was doing this Bible study, I was not doing the theology of healing, which was the one that was most interesting. And one day, I was realizing this, a group of young men, only women, and I realized I was just not reaching them. You know how you could be in a room and you're like, just not going there. And so I stopped the class, or stopped the Bible study, and sort of said, you know, I experience this feeling of alienation from God. I just can't figure out how to make these theologies work for me sometimes. And I said it a little more, you know, plainly in the context. And I said, well, let's just think together. What would it be if you really thought God would understand the experience you are having? And there was in that Bible study, young men who were on stretchers because they hadn't yet been able to stabilize their spine enough to get them into chairs. There were a whole range of quadriplegia and paraplegia and other forms of, you know, disability. And after a while, a young man who had been reared, an African-American man who had been reared in the church, said to me, you know, if God was in a sip puff, which is a wheelchair you move by blowing and inhaling and exhaling, God might understand this, you know? And we talked then a little bit about it because there was a statue out front that had a man, it was in a sitpuff and it was a part of an Olympic, was a Paralympic person. And we were talking about, you know, what would it be like if God was in a sitpuff and sort of we didn't have a huge amount of movement. But then in my exegesis class, like 3 weeks later, we were working on the Luke passage. And there's not enough Bibles in here. There are no Bibles in here except for the one I have. Oh, this is the story. Actually, it was mentioned in Vespers the other night. This is the story where Jesus is returning in the post-resurrection. And the friends of Jesus have become disconsolate, desperate, not knowing what happened to this Messiah that we had. And they are gathered, and this is the way the passage goes. Luke 24, 36 through 39. While they were talking about this, which meaning really their depression and disconsolation, Jesus himself stood among them, and they were startled, terrified, and thought they were seeing a ghost. And he said to them, "Why are you frightened? Why do doubts arise in your hearts? Look at my hands and my feet. See, it is I myself. Touch me and see, for a ghost does not have flesh and bones as you see that I have." Well, of course, in the exegesis class, we went to work on why this is not entirely canonical, and there's kind of problems with authorship. But of course, it's part of the stories we have read, and it is a part of what I think of as our hidden history. Here is the resurrected Christ presenting what have to be disfigured and disabled hands and feet. How would one walk on the feet of post-crucifixion, right? And if we think about the embodiment that Jesus is really trying to evoke, right? He's trying to say, don't be afraid. See, this is I'm not a ghost. I'm flesh of some sort. I have no idea what it means exactly. But this was a different resurrected Christ than one that I'd ever seen or ever been taught about, right? The resurrected Christ that I usually have seen was sort of, may have marks, right? We talk marks of the crucifixion, but not the experience in the body of hands and feet deformed from the crucifixion and presenting them as a sign of welcome and familiarity rather than a sign of anxiety producing or some so kind of calming. So I began to think about that young man's comment about the sip puff and this comment about, or this passage about the post-resurrection Christ. And I began to think about the fact that, in fact, our Christ is a disabled God. And I kind of worked on that for a while, trying to think, well, what would this mean? As a Christology, what does it mean as a way of thinking about Christ, a way into the story that God has about God's self and that God has for humankind? That this is, in many ways, I could go back to that Bible study and say, not a sip puff, but God experienced in God's body the experience of disability. Tonight we're going to read in Vespers. Emily asked me for some passages from different people with disabilities or people who've spoken about the experience of disability. One of the passages I gave her is a passage by a Catholic woman who experienced quadriplegia and was having an absolute dependence, as we talked about a bit in another session, this experience of not being able to move at all and not being able to care for herself and really becoming very depressed and anxious. And there was a crucifix on her wall, and she said, "I realized as I looked up," I'm not going to quote her exactly because I can't, "that Christ on the cross experienced quadriplegia." What I saw there was not the suffering and the bleeding and some, you know, sometimes that she had talked about, she had earlier in the past that she talked about sort of having that experience from child, but that Christ was immobile on the cross. That's the point of the cross, right? It's not only to cause suffering and to cause impairment, but also to immobilize, to humiliate through immobilization the living Christ. And so she began to think about that experience. And so I've discovered through time that there are, that lots of folks with disabilities have had this experience of thinking, how is it that Christ experienced the kinds of experiences I am having in my body? And using that then to think about the Christological truths that we work with, right? That Christ is with us and for us and in us in ways that we are still coming to know. So that really was the start of trying to work on this, the book that was, that ended up being The Disabled God. It was my master's thesis at for Rebecca initially, and then I revised some. Because it was really an effort to try to figure out then, who is this God for me? Who is this God for the guys in my Bible study? And how do we think about it in the story of the Christian tradition, as well as in the biblical passages? And then also finding ways to move toward new practices that enact this new finding, right? So practices that will allow us a full place in the Christian community. And so that's really how and why I wrote the book. But one of the things people ask me, well, why do you call it Liberatorian rather than Liberation? And as I worked through this, I realized, you know, liberation so often means a removal from, right? There's never going to be a removal. Removal from my body is not a good thing, right? that prospect does not leave me a way forward. And so I was trying to think about how to talk about this experience as liberatory, even as it acknowledges and lives fully into the limits of human, of the range of human variation, right? Instead of thinking of this as an exceptional experience that only a few of us will experience about a fifth of us will experience significant disability before we begin the process of aging, in which we often then experience it again in different ways. But that was a way to sort of think through this question of, well, you know, we can think about different models of God for different groups, but how does this really model a way of thinking about God that is for everyone, right? It's not about giving the disabled their own God, right? It's not about giving African Americans their own image of God. But all of these models of God help us think about this fascinating and complex reality of God in ways that allow us a little way forward. And so it, for me, became a way of thinking about the resurrection not as this kind of triumphant, you know, that you see, I grew up with the big pictures of the return of Christ in the clouds. I always say, you know, when I see a cloud burst sometimes, I'm like, wait a minute, return of Christ, you know, because all the pictures in my Sunday school classes were about these cloud bursts, and there comes Jesus, and it's this kind of anxiety-producing thing. So, but this was a way of thinking about how God could be fully in body and fully transcendent. That's still, I have to say, that's still complex for me. And I sometimes I have written it better than I can say it extemporaneously. So I want to just talk a little about the way I think about the resurrection. The resurrection is not about the negation or erasure of bodies. And that's often been the way in which we've sort of thought about putting off this mortal being, right? This not not taking it with us in any way that we release it. And I don't know how this is going to happen. I don't, you know, immortality is not one of those things that's been revealed to me. But it is this Christ that came in a resurrected form that transformed the experience of embodiment. Now, to not erase the experiences that we accumulate in our body. And for some folks with disabilities, that is not initially a great story, right? Those young men in my Bible study, if they couldn't be returned to their prior selves now, they wanted to be in some eternal life, return to that. And I think about the book A Whole New Life by Reynolds Price. Reynolds Price, in his middle age experience, he's a Southern author. I live in Atlanta, and he's sort of one of our Southern authors that are in the air. And he experienced a tumor on his spine and had to have surgery, and it damaged the spinal cord. And so he started in middle age as a person with paraplegia and some upper body immobility at times. And he wrote this book, A Whole New Life, and there's a passage in it that I have committed to memory. And he says, I know now that I will never be the person I used to be. The question is, who will I be now and forever? And of course, we all through our lives have these transformative experiences, right, that mean that you're never going to be that person again. And disability is one of those experiences, if it comes on it's transformative as a congenital, but it has a different kind of quality of transformation if it comes on when you're accustomed to the temporarily able-bodied advantages, right? The ways in which we can move in the world without thinking about steps to take and which way to move and how to get places, especially with physical disability. But that transformation means that now it's not a question of a good life you had and a diminished life you'll have forever after, but a transformed life that now you have to figure out. And that's really what he does in that book, A Whole New Life, is trying to figure out how to live as fully as possible in his new life. And, you know, Reynolds Price is somebody who has learned to do that, I think, in many ways, and a model for many of us. So the experience of Jesus' disability transformed the Trinity. I'm still trying, working out in my own mind. I'm not sure I'll ever work that out. But I know that it did, because Jesus took into the Godhead the experience of putting on flesh. Right? That was part of the purpose of incarnation. Right? We live or die by our incarnations of God. And this is an incarnation that I think transforms not only our understanding of Christ, the disabled God, but moves forward in transforming the understanding of the Trinity as we have it as well. What does it mean then to be a part? I use the image of family because that's one with which I am familiar. A family with a disability, right? What does that mean for the Godhead? To be part of this transformed experience of embodiment. For me, that's exciting. I have to say that that gives me more than any theological word that has come to me yet in my life. That gives me a sense that my place in the Christian story is with the actors, with God, not with the people who have to be acted upon or are outside the gates, or are outside, you know, the ones to be healed. But the Jesus story pulls us into the acting of Christology, the acting of what it means to be God, in ways that allow me to imagine myself as a part of this Christian story in new ways. And I have to say, I'm still working on it. And when I ask people to consider this model of God, I hope that I'm not asking you to displace all other models of God, but rather to think about it, how might it transform in some ways your expectations of God, your expectations of what good humanity is, right? That is in the image of God. We talked a bit about that a couple of days ago, the image of God, the ways in which that acts on us and pushes us down in many contexts, tells us that we can't participate in this great story of the Christian tradition. So that's it in a nutshell, the kind of Christological. I'm going to talk a bit about some practices, what I've called empathic hope and just listening, and I'm a bit of listening for the cries of justice that aren't sort of set out as platform. And we're going to talk about that in a bit. But I wanted to sort of stop there and see if you have reflections yourself, how that strikes you, how that what it evokes in you, the whole range. It doesn't have to be, if you think, nah, I can handle that too. Paul, please.
Well, I think one of the things that's hardest for me to articulate, both personally and theologically, is the relationship between acceptance and transformation. Mm-hmm. Because transformation means change and acceptance doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what has happened in my adult life theologically is redemption has changed from meaning change. I once was lost, but now I'm found, was blind, but now I see. That sort of conversion to more of a 12-step kind of understanding that by accepting who I am transformed in the acceptance. And I mean, in your story, I hear all the words. I hear acceptance and validation and transformation.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just curious how you put them together.
That's both a kind of personal question, and I can answer it better at a personal question than as a theological.
Yeah.
But of course, the nature of any real encounter with our limits, real encounter with being human, right? And as I've said before, limits aren't something that people with disabilities have. They're everybody's. We just have them at different ways and different times over a lifetime. And for me, the experience of God somehow grasping me has made it possible for me to grasp elements of my limits in ways that aren't about kind of fighting. I think I spent much of my early life fighting my disability, right? And that was a little bit the way I was taught to do it, right? That you were supposed to resist the undertow. Disability was a bit of an undertow that would make you, if you didn't push against it, make you weak and make you feel sorry for yourself. That was always the one that was present. And so there was always the sense that you needed to resist your disability in a kind of fundamental way. And that was part of what I talk about in the book, the medical model, right? That these things should be remediated through brace. Up until my early 20s, I was in braces and, just all the time there was an effort to rehabilitate. That was the rehabilitation model, to kind of try to make body parts that didn't move the way they were supposed to move the way they were supposed to. And the experience of this, as I was in seminary and then sort of after seminary, has really allowed me to accept both God's acceptance of my humanity and then accept my own acceptance of these things. And that makes it both easier to then acknowledge and pay attention to them. I would always, I would find myself constantly, I would do crazy things just to prove that I could do it, and then I would suffer. It would be like trying to climb one of these very steep trails just to prove that my disability wasn't making these things impossible. I did hang gliding in Germany while I was on crutches, which it makes no sense whatsoever to anybody concerned. But it was this constant push against the disability in order to prove it wasn't there. And it was, and it came back and bite me in the ass if I wasn't careful. So the experience of God, sort of living now into the acceptance of God and knowing that this is somehow a part of God, the experience of disability and limited embodiment is part of God, and I can relax into it and figure out what it's going to be. That's been an important part of my own spiritual story. And I think that that's theologically significant as well. I think it is about not just the sort of God putting up an inclusive statement on God's self, that now this is a safe zone, but God being fully involved in the experience, right? That's the interplay of full involvement. I don't know exactly how that happens, right? We can say that about many different experiences, that God is fully involved in them in some profound way, and that transforms God as well as humankind. And so that's where I'm sort of working out this the theological significance in a kind of academic maybe or a written down way. But I know that experientially it has given me a much greater calmness about my experience of humanity. And it's given me, I guess, a sense of, until I wrote The Disabled God, which never really talks about my experience except for right at the end I have a couple of illustrations, but it's so deeply personal that, when Rebecca said, I want you to send this to a publisher, I wouldn't do it. I couldn't imagine that this piece of me would be out there and people would say stuff about it. it's like sending a baby out to have people comment upon. And so she ended up sending it without me knowing it was there. So then I got these, it was a little disconcerting. And that process of experiencing it helped me sort of think about this is a story I can share, right? Disability was something that was so deeply personal to talk about it in public with folks. Until I had, it was just not, it was not a way, that wasn't a way I was comfortable in moving. And so I think this experience of the disabled had given me that too, to be able to tell my story as a part of ordinary stories, right? It's not, I don't have to do this as any way to be inspirational. That was the effect of that, the experience of being the poster. I don't have to be inspirational. I can just be who I am in the experience of the Christian church as well.
I think it really does work theologically, and it's very helpful because substitute the word broken for disabled.
Mm-hmm.
And anthropology teaches that we are all broken. But it's really a reversal about what popular Christianity says about sinfulness.
Mm-hmm.
That sinfulness should somehow be resisted, and it leads to an inherent self-righteousness,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to a notion of God living into
mm-hmm.
our brokenness,
mm-hmm.
our wrongness, our sinfulness, that
mm-hmm.
is accepting and liberatory.
Mm-hmm.
I like that, that
mm-hmm.
word. It does it because we don't leave our sinfulness.
See, I'm having trouble with that, the liberation versus liberatory.
Mm-hmm.
And I come at it primarily from women's movement and from queer liberation,
mm-hmm.
and it's not being liberated from either of those identities,
mm-hmm.
but from the oppressiveness that targets those
mm-hmm.
things.
Yep.
And so I'm
yeah. Well, I'm absolutely, the distinction we have to make, I think, always is between the limits that God blesses and gives us as a part of human nature and the limits that are imposed.
Right.
And that is part of the discernment of liberatory practice, is that it is hard at first, once you, to figure out which is this, right? I mean, especially in the when you have with a congenital disability, when I've been just so medicalized from birth, sometimes it's very hard to figure out what are the human limits that are just part of, and what are the kinds of limits that are what we call normalcy pressure, the pressure to become the normal and something other than what you are. So it's not a quest. I'm absolutely oriented to the justice piece of it, but it's also, it gave me a way of resisting elements of utopian theory in the Marxian underpinnings of Latin American liberation theology in general, right? That there is a kind of bodily or social utopia toward which we are all moving. That does not make sense to me. I mean, because that notion of the kind of that there is this thing that we know that is out there doesn't make sense of what I think of as the transformative nature of God. That God is transforming, and God will become with us who God will be. That it will likely move toward these more not utopia, not utopic, but the more the visions of the life of the beloved community. But I really did intentionally try to kind of break elements of that Marxian utopianism, because I guess that it had so acted physically on me as a person with a disability that I really wanted a way to sort of say, well, let's really consider elements of the dangers of utopia, right? And I do this one lecture I give sometimes on the ways in which the notions of utopia really comes from the Greek tradition, and Hephaestus, the only disabled god, was cast out, right? So there's this early tradition in which utopian means that folks with disabilities can't be there. And it's, I think, traditionally carried us through to our visions of heaven, right? That's one of the, heaven is the single most, besides praying, right? Americans say they pray, in 96 it was 90% of Americans say they would pray through. It's lower just now. We're not sure exactly. We don't have a rapid secularizing movement. It's way questions get asked, right? Sociologists note that the way we ask questions. But the next strongest belief in American population is belief in heaven. We have almost no decent theology in heaven in the more liberal. Heaven is embarrassing to us. We don't want to talk about heaven. We don't want to think about heaven. Heaven, it just embarrasses us. So that we then let popular theology run amok. And we sing about it, but we don't want a respectable academic theologian to write about heaven is like, that, because I was in New Zealand doing some lectures, and I talked about heaven, and I had this very nice young, an older man come to me afterwards and tell me, We don't really believe in heaven here. Like, I keep singing about it here in your hymns. I don't know where is it gone in the next one is Satan, right? And again, not something we really want to talk about as a personal thing. But I think the utopic vision of heaven acts back on, in the same way it acted back on my Bible study members, to say, in some ways this isn't the God-given life. God is giving you a different kind of life in a different place, in another time. Think about that and not this life.
Which gets into that whole dualistic.
Exactly, and it's just a killer. I mean, it really is a killer. It tells you to deny yourself in all kinds of ways. And it's one of those theologies that I say, pastors still sometimes feel that it's an acceptable theological good word to give to folks with disabilities. In heaven, it will be made right. That for me is theological malpractice in some sick ways, because it just so much says, don't live. This is not the right life. This is not the way God intended it. God doesn't want your life. God wants another kind of life.
Well, and in the same way that self-righteousness destroys community, because anytime righteousness is defined by who we are, then somebody who's not that, mm-hmm. may or may not fit utopic visions, mm-hmm. are devastating to community.
Yeah. Because they always tell you.
Describing that exact thing, that you don't fit this vision, right. So.
And they always tell you, I mean, they're discouraging in the end, I think.
Yeah.
Utopic visions tell you you're never there, right? And I think that there are, I always tell, I didn't say it in here, but I'm really trained as a sociologist. I'm a theologian because I need to be. It's a theologian by necessity. And I did a master's work in theology, too, so and work in a theology school, so I'm not entirely without resources. But I always tell my students in sociology classes, think seriously about your theory of social change. Because how you think social change happens will tell you how you can be motivated to pursue it. Right? If you think it's maybe Marxian, and I'm not going to go into all that now, but then revolution is how you ought to pursue it, right? And it is this kind of dramatic leap forward. If you think it is more, as we say, Weberian or sort of historical transformation happens, then you have a different model of how you work for change. But your theory of social change drives you whether or not you have articulated what it is.
Right.
And so utopic visions have a strong theory of social change that in some ways don't give you a mechanism forward in certain ways, except for these rapid transformations that don't happen often, right? You know, so then the hard slogging gets really depressing. Please.
So what happens when people feel they try different methods of social change and they don't work?
Yeah. I have to say, as a person with disability, social change is happening. It's slow. Right now it's depressing with the ADA. You know, we're taking away elements of the ADA through court cases. You know, we had this move forward with ADA. But from the time when I was a child, when it was pretty, I mean, you know, I take myself to be literate and decently, you know, but the assumption in prior to 73 was that I didn't need to be educated. And I couldn't ask for my school district to make accommodations to educate me. And my sister didn't have a right to education either. And so you're right, social change, there is sort of these stalls, I think. We're right now in a stall. My husband, I don't know if it's offensive out here, I can't trail all the things that may or may not be, but my husband said, you know, I feel a little like I'm in the lost tribe of liberals out here at home. Because, you know, in Atlanta, you know, I mean, we live in an in-town place, but still republicanism is just, and so I feel like we're just in this stall for progressive social change. But I have to say, over my lifetime, and I'm not, the amount of change that has happened for folks with disabilities in particular gives me the sense that I am encouraged by it. And folks, you know, we certainly, I have worked on the front lines of advocacy work in disability in particular for years. And, you know, it gets depressing when we can't get MARTA to do our mass transit, to do some basic things, you know. On the other hand, when we kind of look back over, well, let's see what's happened in the last 5-10 years, we can see some real progress.
Well, when you're focused on getting your mass transit to change, mm-hmm. and you hear from someone who's not disabled, well, there have been changes.
Yeah, no.
That's where
I think MLK's letter from the Birmingham jail is just exactly right. Nobody else can tell us to be patient.
Right.
You can't tell me to be patient. My job is to push. And I will push. I will continue to push for inclusivity and for more social participation. I don't accept the be patient. I can't accept it. because our lives are on the line, right? I worked for a while with the UN Special Commissioner for High Commissioner for Refugees, looking at disability in refugee populations and thinking about the moral issues involved in that. Well, people with disabilities die as refugees at a rate of something like 6 times folks without disabilities, and people are more likely to be disabled in that context. So, as a worldwide, we can't say no. We're doing okay. Let's do it. On the other hand, for me, it's an important thing to kind of say we are making certain. I mean, the proclamation. One of the things that has surprised me about UN proclamations in the U.S. we don't really notice them. They're just kind of despised and not particularly attended to. And the UN is this evil New York institution and not part of all of our lives. But some countries, when they make UN proclamations about, for example, the rights of all people with disabilities and the right to education, they actually begin working on this or push forward things. And that has been a global reality that kind of has come as a shock to me, to realize in India, for example, after the UN proclamation came out in 89, they began working seriously for the education of more and more people with disabilities. And I have seen in this short while a real kind of culture shift among elements of the state education institution. So even those things give me a way to think about God is transforming the world in the image of God's self, who is a disabled God. And the world is able to see this increasingly, I think. I pray and I work as a practice of hope to believe as not something that is a lack, a deficit, something we have to cure, eliminate, right? But rather a part of the variation of God's people and part of the variation of human nature, right? Humankind. Right? So when the UN proclamations, they don't always produce those changes, but they can. So that makes me encouraged as well. LWF, Lutheran World Federation, has a major initiative on including women, the women organization, is the women's desk, is what they always call it. But in Geneva, they have a major initiative on incorporating women with disabilities into their leadership. And I was one time I was there. There was a woman with a disability who worked for Makane Yesu, the Ethiopian Lutheran body, and she had worked for, I want to say maybe 15 years for the national organization without pay because she was a person with disability. They didn't think her labor was the same. She worked as a bookkeeper. She had significant mobility impairment, but she hadn't been paid from all that time. And so that was a real hardship on her and her family. And as a part of this initiative, they asked each of the contributing denominations or the Lutheran bodies to invite a woman with a disability to come to Geneva. Well, this woman had not ever been really out of her area, and she came to Geneva. She began to talk to other women with disabilities, and as we've corresponded with her, she's now being paid for the labor she's doing. So there are these things that make me think, us speaking up, saying, here we are, we're part of the body of Christ, here we are, we're here still, we're going to be here as a part of the Christian story for the entirety of God's work, include us, allow us not only to be welcomed on your terms, but let us redefine what the terms can be in some ways. That's the challenge. People often talk about hospitality, and that's not a bad initial place. But hospitality generally means you get to set the table and I get invited in. And I think that's not a bad place to start. I mean, I grew up in a in a decently Norwegian area of North Dakota, you know. People set decent tables. I'm glad to be there. But after a while, I want it to be the place where I can invite you for hospitality, right? I want to be, the Christian church is as much mine as it is yours, and we can, the truth of the fact that there have been so many groups that have not been at home in the Christian church is part of what we're revealing, right? That this has not been about our common experience. We've had very specific ways in which we've excluded folks over time, and over time the table will be transformed as those of us with different stories, different ways of thinking about the Christian story get to help set the, do the table and transform how the table, how accessible the table is.
I have a friend who, whose husband's a bishop in a Catholic church, and they have a daughter with very severe CP. And at the last church he was at before he was a bishop, the vestry decided how they would deal with Bethany's communion. And that's what you're saying. They decided how the table would be set to include her rather than including her and her parents in the decision. What that table would look like. And it was a very setting her apart. Mm-hmm. And it was very painful.
Right. Well, that's one of the things that I wanted to talk about just a little bit about this just listening. Because I think of it as a practice of social change and justice making. And it's a challenge, in particular in relationship to disability, because some of the people with whom we are engaged aren't able to fully articulate what it is they want, need, and how they will advocate for themselves. And so part of the process of working at just listening, not simply listening, but listening for the claims of justice that get made in everyday life, right, that are part of simply the way people carry themselves through the world. And then help it, letting them tell the story of what they need, what they want. People with very severe disabilities. I've been on the board of Atlanta Alliance on Disability for a number of years, and they, over time, working with them to self-advocacy really means that they get to define certain things. They get to say how they want things. And you know, there are people with very severe disabilities that are never able to do that. But of course, they are what I call the limit case. People often use limit cases to sort of say, can't do all. Well, they're not, most people with disabilities, we can engage in that process of in interplay. And those folks with disabilities who can't, they're usually a circle of caregivers or a circle of people who have claimed them who can help us engage in that as well. So, and it's not always easy and it's not always pleasant. I have my, we have to know that this is just listening challenges us, pushes us to say, okay, well, what is it that we can, what are able to do? What can we listen to? How do we push ourselves to listen and work at greater empathy? And that practice of just listening means we have to settle ourselves often with folks with disabilities, find our place where we are comfortable physically, you know, sort of be able to settle ourselves in order to give attention. This is not something we do easily in a fast-paced, you know, world where you have to be producing all. This is a kind of work of contemplative practice, engaging with folks who have not yet sort of put their needs and rights on a kind of panel that they can say, this is what I need, this is what I want. Lots of folks with disabilities have never been encouraged to tell folks what they want and how they need to do things. And so part of this contemplative practice of just listening with someone is working forward. And well, I think you're doing, I think this is what you're saying you want, and this is, you know, working how my sister, one of the things I was very pleased, the names I can say, there's a couple of families here with children with disabilities, with one of whom I've talked, saying that this was a vacation. And my sister, that was one of the things she discovered she really wanted. We all got to do vacations. She wanted to do a vacation on her own and figuring out all right, if this is what's really important to her, how do we do it? How do we get the circle of support for her to be able to do this? And how do we make this a part of what she considers her ordinary life? So the practice of just listening, I think, is one of the most important, because people with disabilities have often been advocated for, but it's been hard sometimes to get congregations, denominations, social bodies to listen enough that folks can advocate for themselves. And that's especially in the area of cognitive, developmental, psychiatric disabilities. That's just a vital area of learning how to practice what it means to be the body of God together. So I wanted to give us just a little more time to speak and think. If you have things you want to ask about, it's been a little more free, open, but I thought maybe that would be a good one for my last session. Anybody have questions, thoughts, puzzlements?
Do you teach this in a class or classes?
Yeah, actually I do. I teach it more disciplined in a class, you know. I mean, in a course.
What kind of course?
Course. I teach a course on disability and theology and religion. And we start out with sort of the model of disability studies as it's come into sort of thinking about cultural representations of disability and how that happens in different areas of theology and religious studies. There are some interesting historical work. Again, I hear tonight a passage from Helen Keller. You know, when I start sessions, classes, ask people, well, who are the people with disabilities you can know? You know, and it's Roosevelt and it's Helen Keller, but a lot of times the piece of what they know, especially with Helen Keller, is the story of, okay, now it's
Annie Sullivan.
Yeah, Annie Sullivan. Well, what's the story? What's the name
Miracle
of the
Worker.
Miracle Worker, right? Which is about Annie Sullivan, not about Helen Keller. But Helen Keller grew up, and she had an impressive activist career in her life, and so that's not usually part of the story. At least some of my students. So we do some historical work about sort of who are the people and what are the stories that we sort of need to recover in order to think about theology. Then we do some work on theological models, and then we do some work on practical theology, looking at homiletics a little bit. I mean, the challenge has been because there is not enough literature in the sociology of religion and disability, right? So there's more, it's a range of things. But usually students can use that as, what I try to do is sort of think about the sets of disciplines in theology, you know, biblical studies and systematic and experiential theology, practical theology, and cultural studies. And I use those models to work through the class. So. And there's now enough literature. One of the things I did, when people would say to me, you know, when I do the Disabled Guide came out in 94, and sometimes people would say, well, that's an interesting thing, but there's nothing in my area, nothing in my field, academics would say. And so Don Saliers and I got together a group of scholars to do something explicitly that would address the different areas of theology. There's biblical studies, there's systematic theology, and the kind of loci theology. There's a practical theology, and there's cultural studies. There's a really great piece on folklore in the West and how disability shows up. There's a great story about how this person with a significant mobility impairment does pretty well when he's on a horse. And, you know, sort of that story of the way in which the traditional practices of the West in some ways advantaged people with certain kinds of disabilities. So it's an interesting piece. And so that's sort of the way I organize the course as well.
And how did you do that book then? That's an anthology?
Yeah, to collect it, edit. We got a grant from Lilly, and we go out together, scholars, to talk about these things, and then ask them to draft something, and then we got together again and asked them to redraft. And so what's interesting is it spurred folks in biblical studies. Out of the folks that did this, they developed the Society for Biblical Literature. Now has a sub area that is on disability in biblical literature. There's an area, but I was one of the co-founders of the area, the American Academy of Religion on Disability has a sub area and a group on disability. And that really, in some ways, came out of organizing scholars for this, so that we could begin to. What's exciting for me at this stage of my life, honestly, is that there are lots of folks doing dissertations that incorporate the questions of disability that really are working some on it. And so that's exciting to me to say. Part of the challenge is to begin to train pastors as well and clergy and undergraduates in ways that allow them to work towards transformation as well. And so sometimes it's just as much as having a disabled professor, right? And people would say, "Well, I don't ever think of you as disabled." I would say, "Well, why not?" I certainly am, right? So just because of the assumptions about power and disability mean disabled professor also doesn't work exactly, and yet there's a lot of us out there. So this is the end of that conversation. Thank you for taking the time to be here. I appreciate it, and I hope that you will continue to mull these things and as you work on other areas of your life as well. Thank you.